Food rights, food freedom, the illusion of choice. Grocery store shopping is starting to show the cracks in the system from years of consolidation of meat and milk and egg production. Your choices are made for you, and it's not always clear. Buy beef from the cattle farmer in your state. Buy raw milk or raw butter or raw cheese. Good luck. Eggs you can probably find from a neighbor, but those other products you may not, as in you are not allowed to buy, so says your food overlords of the USDA and the FDA. The consolidation of meat processing started with the Wholesome Meat Act of 1967. You might think that's a good idea. When you learn that the whole thing can be stopped by shutting down one plant, that's a problem. That's the problem we have now. My guest talks about what the Wholesome Meat Act was intended to do. We also talk about where we are now, today, May 2020, and what it might take to get out of this mess. The Culinary Libertarian Podcast, episode 86.
Welcome to the Culinary Libertarian Podcast, where the philosophy is free, but the food is on you.
Hello, everybody. Dan Reed here, the Culinary Libertarian. Welcome back to the podcast. Happy to have you here. Happy to be here. Amble over to my podcasts page, culinarylibertarian.com/podcasts, to find the archive of all the previous shows, show notes pages, and my social media link tabs, so you can follow the Culinary Libertarian on Twitter or on Instagram. You can also join my Eating Liberty Facebook group. We've got cooks and bakers and people who like to eat. If that's you, come on in. From that podcast's page, click the support link to visit my support page. You'll see some of my affiliate banners, including the Tom Woods Liberty Classroom link and McClanahan Academy link. Both are excellent membership programs with content on history and the Declaration of Independence and the Constitution, documents currently well overlooked these last few weeks. Learn about what was intended and how far we are from that now. You can also join Kiko's Cakes and learn from a pastry chef how to make and bake pastry shop quality desserts at home. Kiko's instructions and video lessons are excellent. And won't Dad love a great dessert for Father's Day dinner? Yes, yes he would. And also for Father's Day, or just because it's Tuesday, visit my Cranky Without Coffee mug store for that perfect coffee mug gift. Lastly, support the show with a rating and a review on your favorite podcatcher. That helps more people find the show, and that grows the audience. My guest today is Pete Kennedy. Pete is an attorney in Sarasota, Florida, and was a founding member of the Farm to Consumer Legal Defense Fund and served in leadership positions for many years there. He continues to work as a member services attorney for both Farm to Consumer and for the Weston A. Price Foundation. He advises on policy and legal matters, including state legislation regarding raw milk, cottage foods, food sovereignty, poultry processing, and on-farm/custom slaughter, and has worked on issues governing raw milk production and distribution since 2004. Welcome, Pete. Thank you for joining me today on the Culinary Libertarian Podcast.
Thanks for having me, Dan.
My pleasure. Let's start with an introduction. I've already told the people a little bit about you.
Okay, sure. I've worked on food and agricultural law issues, I guess, for about the last 17 years now. I'm a consultant for the Weston Price Association. I do some legal services work for Farm to Consumer Legal Defense Fund. I've worked for both those organizations for a number of years now. started out working a lot on raw milk issues, but I also work more on meat regulations these days, too. And as we know, that's a bigger topic than ever.
It certainly is. So in the course of 85 or so episodes, I've done a few episodes on food rights and food freedom. And one constant is the high level of idiocy when it comes to some agency seeking power and enforcing or inventing rules to enforce some display of power. So one way currently is for the USDA and state equivalent agencies to deem contraband food as improperly labeled. That's a no-win situation for the farmer or the producer. But before we get too deep into the weeds, let's set the table, so to speak, with a few items. The FDA and FSIS, the Food Safety and Inspection Service, are all, and all the other agencies are, as written, unconstitutional. The FDA and the USDA have, as such, no authority to do what they do, yet here we are talking about them doing what they're doing. So, as brief as you can, how did we get here? Is this the Earl Butz legacy, or is there something else going on?
Well, just, yeah, you can go back to the beginning of the 20th century where they Congress passed the Federal Meat Inspection Act and the Food and Drug Act. Around the same time and up to that time and even a bit after, just farms could sell direct to consumers without hardly any regulation at all. I mean, there are some towns maybe that would counties that might impose some kind of licensing requirement, but it was more a revenue raiser. There really wasn't that much regulation that I've able to find at all. And so what happened was, just as food production moved to the urban areas, you know, there were a lot of these dairies that moved to the city, these swill dairies producing poor quality milk. Just as the meat production wound up getting more urbanized, there were some food safety problems, but basically, the farmers, the small farmers in this country weren't the cause of the problem. So they got dragged into this regulatory scheme for reasons that weren't of their own making. And ever since then, there's just more and more consolidation in food production. You know, the areas I follow mostly are meat and dairy, and there's just been tremendous consolidation. And the there is a landmark amendment to the Federal Meat Inspection Act called the Wholesome Meat Act in 1967, which has really laid the groundwork for the course events ran to where we are today. And that is just what that law did, was it consolidated meat production to the point now where there are four meat packers that handle over 80% of the beef production in the country. There are another four meat packers that account for over 60% of the pork production in the country. And just, that's a dangerous type of system to have, because if something goes wrong with the just one of those four or all of them, like it's happening now, you're just really running the risk of broken down supply lines. And that's what's happening during the COVID-19 crisis.
Well, it seems that the perhaps unintended consequence of the consolidation of production and processing was the consolidation of trucking and distribution. And so I think we're getting a double whammy here, where I think I just read something that they're dispatching 150,000 pigs a day. That's a lot of pigs. So if they can't process the animals and then they can't deliver the animals, Now we got a big problem.
Yeah, it's there. Well, there's actually a law that you're aware of called the Prime Act before Congress right now, which would allow the sale of custom slaughtered meat within an intrastate commerce. I mean, the way it is now, you can't sell any meat unless you get the meat slaughtered and processed at a facility where there's either a federal or a state inspector. They're federally inspected meat plants and state inspected meat plants, and just there's a shortage of them. And what that's done is forced these farmers to euthanize their animals because they can't afford to keep hoarding them. They've already passed the date where they're ready for slaughter, and like you said, there are just no other distribution channels because they have to go to a facility where an inspector is there to get their animals processed. And what's happening right now is, you know, around the time the Wholesome Meat Act was passed, there was close to 10,000 slaughter plants in the country. Today, it's under 3,000. You know, think of how much bigger our population is today than it was in 1967, the greater demand for meat. And at the same time, I'd say, you know, over 1,000 of these plants are custom plants where, yeah, you can't sell the meat from that plant. Only the owner can get the meat. So you might be talking under 2,000 plants in the country right now that have an inspector present, and these farms selling, these farmers and ranchers selling to the big processors. Yeah, there's no room at those smaller plants for them now, so they're stuck.
Wyoming recently passed a state law that basically nullifies federal law. And I think the qualification in Wyoming was that it had to be a herd share. But now in Wyoming, if I understand it correctly, people who are part of the herd share can get from the rancher custom cut meats. Now, there's probably the abattoir in between, but what's missing is the federal agencies. And you wrote a piece about something similar in Tennessee. So I know that I just spoke to John Moody last week, and we were talking about the Prime Act, and it's still live in Congress. So what can the citizens of the several states do to help move the Prime Act forward to get it passed? And maybe at the same time, what can citizens of the several states do in their states to relieve some of the pressure so that we don't need this legislation, or we don't need the current, I'm misspeaking. We can nullify the federal laws at the state level so people can get food.
Okay. So, I mean, the number one thing they can do right now is to call their senators and their representative and just tell them to sponsor the Prime Act. I think, as you know, this is the third session of Congress that the Prime Act has been introduced. It was first introduced back in 2015, but just it's got the attention. There's never going to be more attention focused on it, I think, than there is right now. So it's just crucial to call up. As there's a story in the media every day, or a series of stories on these plants closing down, or even if they reopen, they're reopening with slower production times. And there's just incredible consolidation in the industry. There are, I think, a dozen plants that handle over 50% of the beef production in the country, and around that, maybe a couple more that handle something like close to 60% of the pork production. And a number of these plants are either shut down now or shut down and just recently started back up. So it's, really, USDA has just suspended enforcement of these other food laws. So has FDA since the COVID-19 crisis started. They really should do that right now and suspend enforcement on the prohibition against the sale of meat from a custom facility. But just unfortunately, USDA is one of the biggest opponents of the Prime Act. So it's up to, just people to call their congressional representatives and see if they can get this bill expedited. On the state level, what you can do is what Wyoming did, which was to pass a law just kind of expanding the interpretation of the of these law rules on custom slaughter. Because usually, typically with USDA, there can only be individual owners of an animal, and the herd share is kind of in a gray area, but it's an area that needs to be pushed right now. Because with a herd share, you're talking about a number of individuals getting meat from the animal. It's not a formal group, I guess, per se, but it's something that is arguably within the custom slaughter rules, and it's something that needs to get pushed. I mean, I in the past, it's interesting because USDA has actually allowed the distribution of meat from a custom slaughtered animal through a consumer cooperative. And my understanding is that usually what they do is they want records on each animal, who are the individual owners of that animal, where with a consumer cooperative, that hasn't necessarily been the case. I mean, they might check at the end of the year after a period of time to see if the members of the cooperative got meat in proportion to their share in the cooperative. But it's just like this herd share. It's the kind of thing I think needs to be pushed. And in most of the states, I believe the State Department of Agriculture handles the regulation of the custom facilities. I mean, USDA can go over there anytime they want. They have jurisdiction over them. But I think it's mostly the states. So the states need to wake up and just... This isn't going to get rid of the shortages caused by the shutdowns of these big plants, but it can help alleviate them somewhat. And they need to be, I think, flexible and just have a broader interpretation of who can get receive the meat from a custom processed animal.
I think part of the advantage of beginning pursuing custom butcher is that the next time something like this happens, and we've already seen how easy it is for them to do this, that there isn't the response is already in place. So we're not hurry up working from behind.
Well, I think the other thing too is that, there's some USDA facilities that are both operate as a inspected facility and also do custom slaughter. So they operate as an uninspected facility. But there, if you operate as a USDA facility at all, or even a state-inspected facility, there are just more requirements that kick in. There's the HACCP requirement, which can be used by regulators as a sword against these plants. And, it can be used to put them out of business. I mean, I wasn't working on these issues back in the 90s when HACCP came on, but I just heard from people who were aware of what was going on was that USDA would come in and basically use HACCP to put somebody out of business. I mean, the proprietor of the plant would be responsible for coming up with some kind of plan on safety measures and controlling potential risks in the plant. And the USDA inspector would go, well, that's not acceptable. So the plant supervisor would go, the plant owner would go, okay, well, what do I need to do? And a number of times the response was, well, that's up to you to figure out. So they weren't there to help them really. And like they should have, just my definition of a good regulator is someone who does everything he can to help a food producer while still protecting the public health. And I'm sure a number of these shutdowns had nothing to do with public health, more than just confusion over what USDA wanted with a proper HACCP plan.
Well, having been in the food service industry on the restaurant side and experiencing and at culinary school teaching HACCP, it is phenomenally complicated, even at the small side of the restaurant. So the ability to punish somebody for not following a point on a 200-point system is easy to do.
Right. And what you look at, Dan, is you need a HACCP for all these different foods. Like you want to do sausage, that's a HACCP. You want to do bacon, that's another HACCP. And just the big advantage of the custom houses is you don't have to put up with that. I mean, if the federal, there's some federal regulations you have to follow, but they're pretty minimal for a custom plan compared to what they are for a federal plant. So I've just heard of people who have like a dual plant. They're both under federal inspection. They have a custom plant and they get fed up with the inspectors and they just go to strictly custom. And what happens is that it seems like USDA kind of uses all these myriad of regulations to inspected facilities are accountable for as a management tool where they this is a very small percentage. These small facilities, I don't know, maybe might make up 1 or 2% of total production, not even. So their time is better spent at the big plants, but still under the law, they have to show up to the small plants too. They have to be present when it's small plants slaughtering and processing. So their way out of it is to, be difficult on the small plants, kind of move them toward shutting down. And that means just less time spent with these plants who produce a small amount of the overall production.
Right. I'm going to take a step back for a minute and let's review this one more time. The whole you have an article entitled The Wholesome Meat Act of 1967, Disaster for Small Slaughterhouses from the Start, which I will link to on the show notes page, culinarylibertarian.com/86. And in the article, you cite a Small Business Association report detailing the problems to be found from the passage of the Wholesome Meat Act, and to no real surprise, the bill passed anyway. So if incentive matters, and I think they do, what was in it for Congress to pass this bill in the first place?
Well, it was sold as a consumer protection measure. And there was kind of, it sounded like the federal government sent a number of inspectors out as on kind of a witch hunt to find things wrong with these plants. It was maybe, I think it's actually reflected in that report you just mentioned, where maybe they found something wrong with 1 to 2 percent of the slaughterhouses out there, and what they allegedly found wrong might not have even been a problem. I mean, they were kind of, the people going out in the field were encouraged to find something wrong. So this was sold as a consumer protection measure, just to protect the housewife going to the supermarket to get beef. And really, what it turned out to be was an industry consolidation measure, because that report says that at the time the Wholesome Meat Act was passed, the meat industry was one of the more competitive industries around. And just what the Wholesome Meat Act did was it increased requirements, set up these new building physical facility requirements, which just drove the price up and made it difficult for a lot of these smaller say, community abattoirs to comply. And it put them out of business in no time. I mean, that report was actually written in 1971. I mean, 3 years after the Wholesome Meat Act came out. But it, just reading the report, it's not surprising at all what's happened today, almost 50 years later, because the report basically predicted that this could be a big industry consolidation measure. I mean, they basically, there's a line in the report that says what happened to these small plants with the passage of that law was just the equivalent of being hit with a hurricane. And just like these plants would have needed disaster relief if a hurricane hit, they needed disaster relief to be able to cope with all the requirements of the Wholesome Meat Act.
It's interesting you mentioned that, because I actually have, I think, that very passage highlighted, because I wanted to read this one portion from the report that was there that you mentioned. And the part that I picked out reads like this, quote, "The authors think the empirical evidence contained in this report points inevitably to the conclusion that many firms will suffer substantial economic injury without federal assistance. In fact, many face terminal economic injury without some form of government relief," end quote. My take on that statement is, it reads this way, if we, this or that specific portion of a community, will need federal aid to meet the new federal laws designed to help us. If you're passing a law that makes the people need federal help to meet the law you're passing, then they didn't need before. This is just lunacy.
Yeah, I know. That's not a very good law, is it?
You know, it's a lot like the pharmaceutical industry and the FDA, where the small guy gets squeezed out from all the requirements met needed to be met for research. It's just aggravating.
Well, and you know, really what people need to do, because there's just this belief that you have to have an inspector present at the facility to ensure safety. And I can tell you, I've looked at the numbers. On a typical year, over 20 million pounds of meat are recalled by USDA. And, you know, just a fraction, infinitesimal amount is from custom facilities. I've worked on these issues for about 12 years now. I can only remember one time since I started working on them where there was a recall of meat from a custom facility. In that particular instance, it was actually a dual facility. The problem was with the inspected meat, but they still called along the custom meat anyway. So it, just people have to realize that you had safer food with the old system, and you're going to have safer food with the custom houses as opposed to just a small number of these facilities dominating production. I mean, where do you get better quality control? A custom house that might process anywhere from, you know, a few to a dozen animals a day, or one of these big beef packing plants where they slaughter 300 to 400 animals an hour? It's just there's no comparison. And yeah, it gets to a point where those of us wanting to pass the Prime Act have to just do a better job controlling the narrative on the food safety issue, because safer food is produced in the custom houses than it is in the USDA facilities overall. I don't think there's any doubt about it.
I think you're probably right, but let me just play a devil's advocate for a minute. And so surely safe food and sanitary conditions are important, and nobody would quibble about that. And plainly, nobody wants to get sick from the food they eat. I, myself, am a fan of wholesome food. So the proponents of government would argue that's why we need government to manage this. What's wrong with that picture?
Well, as a libertarian, you know, when you get to create an agency or increase an agency's powers to regulate something. It's against the agency's self-interest to find a solution, so they're no longer needed to regulate anything. I mean, one of the biggest opponents, I think, of the Prime Act is the USDA itself. And in a way, it's kind of surprising because my understanding is they have shortages of inspectors around the country. It would probably make their job easier, enable them to concentrate just on the plant shipping and interstate commerce. But it's a tremendous amount of power they have. I mean, it's the only meat and poultry are really the only foods where the federal government has jurisdiction over intrastate commerce in it. I mean, I'm saying that with the Food Safety Modernization Act, that might have changed a few things. They're still issuing regulations on aspects of that, so we don't know what the final damage on that is. But anyway, before the Food Safety Modernization Act, meat and poultry are the only foods I knew of that were the feds could regulate intrastate. So there's very little incentive for them to support the Prime Act, even though just with the overall shortage of inspectors now, it's something that could help them.
Pete, I do want to get into raw milk for a minute, but before I do that, let's take a moment out for a word from my sponsor. Hey, folks, if you haven't heard about Anchor, it's the easiest way to make a podcast. Let me tell you why. It's free. Free is good. They have creation tools that allow you to record and edit your podcasts right from your phone or your computer. Anchor will distribute your podcast for you, so it can be heard on Spotify, Apple Podcast, Stitcher, CastBox, and many more. You can make money from your podcast with sponsors, just like this one, with no minimum listenership. It's everything you need to make a podcast in one place. And if you use your phone, you can be podcast on the spot, getting news and interesting things, whatever appeals to you, wherever you are. Download the free app to your phone or go to anchor.fm to get started creating your podcast today. You've listened to The World on Podcasts. Now go tell the world your story. Visit anchor.fm today to get started. Now let's get back into the show. Pete, it's a bit off the current food fiasco issue right now, but it is in line with food freedom, and that is what you mentioned before, raw milk. I mentioned before, I spoke with John Moody, and it is his contention that the raw milk issue is less about health and more about control. I think he's right, but how is he right?
Yeah, he's definitely right. And what it is you have this commodity system now, there where you're selling raw milk to a processor. The processing industry is highly consolidated. I mean, the biggest producer co-op in the country by far is Dairy Farmers of America, and they were just the Justice Department just approved them to buy off a good chunk of Dean Milk's business. Dean Milk was the biggest milk processor in the country, and they filed bankruptcy end of last year, I guess. And so if you can make raw milk illegal, it's very difficult for that small farmer selling to the co-op to go elsewhere. I mean, he could get his own bottling and pasteurization equipment, which costs money. He could get equipment to produce and process value-added dairy products, which cost money. What would be cheaper for him would just be to selling raw milk direct to the consumer instead of selling raw milk to the processor. And, you know, the conventional industry just wants you to think milk is milk, and that's not true. There are two different products. Milk produced for pasteurization is a different product than milk produced for human consumption. And one piece of evidence available on that is a occasionally you'd hear of these studies on the high number of pathogens in bulk tank samples that were taken in these conventional dairies producing milk for pasteurization. Well, a number of states that allow the sale of raw milk require the farmers to get licensed to do testing. And there are these testing results in, you know, most or not all of these states where the licensing is required that just show the incidence of pathogens is far less than it is in these dairies producing milk for their commodity market. So this is definitely about protecting industry, not so much protecting the public health. As yeah, a matter of fact, when just over the years, one of the things I did was work on foodborne illnesses that were allegedly caused by raw milk. And, you know, some of those allegations weren't true, but there were some that were. But just as the years have gone on and the education available to dairy farmers from organizations like the Raw Milk Institute and the Farm to Consumer Foundation has increased, I think what we're seeing is just fewer and fewer allegations or foodborne illness outbreaks attributed to raw milk consumption. Last year, Weston Price and the Farm to Consumer Legal Defense Fund are going to get most, they're going to find out about most cases where a raw milk dairy has been blamed for making people sick. And last year, I think Weston Price was contacted about one possible outbreak the entire year. And their statistics from the Centers for Disease Control saying, this was years ago, hasn't been anything done recently from what I know of, just saying there are around 10 million raw milk drinkers in the country. So that, you know, if you want to shut something down for one outbreak, Dan, you'd have to shut down a lot of foods in the country right now. I mean, what's interesting is a lot of these states have legalized raw milk sales, but they haven't legalized the sales of value-added dairy products like butter, kefir, products like that. And, you know, the value-added products are more where the money is. But it's starting to change one by one. States are starting to legalize sales of, say, raw butter, raw cream. I mean, Utah just legalized the sales of those products, and a bill signed into law a month or two ago. Last year, Tennessee legalized raw butter. So there's a trend, you know, slowly towards that happening. But the Farm to Consumer Legal Defense Fund filed a citizen's petition with FDA to lift the ban on raw butter, because raw butter, probably all raw dairy foods, I believe, have a good overall track record for food safety, especially in recent years. But raw butter, the CDC has a database on it. It's like 18, 20 years worth of data, and they don't have a single case, I believe, that's attributed to commercially made raw butter. And so back in 2016, Farm to Consumer Legal Defense Fund filed the citizen petition. It took FDA almost 4 years to answer it, but they just answered it a couple months ago. And they went back and all the way to 1908 to show to list outbreaks they believe was attributed to raw butter. And they submitted a chart, which was very incomplete on the data. It had raw butter consumption. I think there was at least one case of typhoid they blamed on raw butter consumption. They included that in the data. And it basically, even if FDA was right, it wound up to like one outbreak being blamed on raw butter for every 7 to 8 years. And if that's the standard, yeah, there'd be a lot of foods out there would be illegal to eat right now.
And if we assume that the federal government has always applied the clever COVID death count statistics to all the other things they count, there's no reason to trust them on anything.
Oh, yeah. Well, raw milk. Yeah. I mean, it was easy. If you work in the raw milk area, it's easier to see through the statistics the government is coming through with COVID because they just jerry-rig things where they came out with this one report that raw milk is 150 times as likely as pasteurized milk to cause illness. And yeah, if you're going to, it's like the saying goes, there are lies, damn lies, and statistics. And if you're going to, yeah, just anyone doing that on an objective basis, I think wouldn't find anywhere near that. Years ago, I sent a FOIA request to the Centers for Disease Control, just asking, you know, how many illnesses from pasteurized milk versus how many illnesses attributed to raw milk over it was maybe a 35-year period. And there were, probably is over 10 times as many attributed to pasteurized as raw milk. And people will say, well, you know, way more than 10 times as many people drink pasteurized milk. And that's true, but just the amount of illnesses attributed to raw milk was so small, number one, that it's still maybe 40 to 50 illnesses a year on average. This is according to an expert we had work cases for both Legal Defense Fund and Weston Price. And just some of these pasteurized milk outbreaks, they don't have as many outbreaks, but when they have them, there are way more people getting sick. I mean, there was one outbreak they had back in the 80s where they said almost 200,000 people became ill drinking pasteurized milk. And they, you know, the way they characterize it is they say there's a post-pasteurization failure. But the way we look at it was, well, the pasteurization took out the good bacteria, so it wasn't able to fend off the bad bacteria after pasteurization.
Yeah, more unintended consequences.
Right.
You know, in all of this doom and gloom, I do see on my social media feeds moments, glimpses of hope. One of those was a line of cars. I think it was a Pennsylvania egg farm where the guy sent out the alert. Hey, you want eggs? Come and get them. I'm going to give them away. Or I don't know if he sold them. Or I don't know what happened. But instead of destroying them, he found people who wanted them. I think there's a tomato farmer who did the same thing. I've got tomatoes. Bring your boxes. Come and get them. So,
well, I think the other good thing about this is it's pointed a lot more people in the direction of real food. Just because the problems, the distribution problems at the beginning of the COVID crisis, when you had all this food that was supposed to go to restaurants, and schools, it wasn't going there. The restaurants shut down. I had no idea it was this high, but apparently over half the food consumed in this country is done at eating out instead of eating in. So just there was this rush for just wholesome traditional foods like beef and eggs at the food store. People weren't getting what they wanted, so they started looking around more and started finding these farms to buy from. Most of the farms I'm aware of is just they doubled their sales at a minimum the last month or two. So, which almost is another reason to pass the Prime Act. Because even if these, say all the big plants, COVID goes away, all the big plants start up again, just the small farms that, you know, use the small facilities to process their meat are just overwhelmed right now. I mean, what's happening now is they have to book further out to get a spot at a custom facility. So I've always believe there are two food systems, the industrial system and the local food system. And you've just seen a big swing in demand to the local food system, and they're going to need the infrastructure to meet that demand. And right now, I'm not sure they have it. So it's, yeah, it's important for them that a law, that Congress pass a law like the Prime Act, because you're going to need to rebuild the slaughterhouse infrastructure closer to the way it was 50 years ago.
I don't know if your legal knowledge extends to all the states. That would be a lot. But I'm thinking that in some level, it seems for the general citizen of any state to go to the egg farmer or the tomato growers or somebody and get this food from the grower, it seems for a lot of people perhaps a bit of an act of defiance, because you're going outside of the allowable food chain system.
Yeah, just for people growing for the industrial system, I don't know if you're going to, you're necessarily going to get the same quality. I guess a small amount of that is being diverted to direct-to-consumer sales. But like you said earlier, because of problems with transportation and distribution, it's cheaper, I guess, for a lot of these growers to leave their crops unharvested in the field. Yeah, the infrastructure, the infrastructure in a lot of these states is just geared for shipping food outside the state. If you look, the states, I don't know if all states do keep statistics on this, but just the ones who do, I think, if you get a state where much more than 10% of the food consumed in the state is produced in the state, that's a pretty high number. So for all reasons, for the strength of the local economy, just stronger communities, more prosperous family farms, better consumer health, better food safety, the local food system needs to get as much market share as it possibly can. Because just looking at the economy in general, just one of the leading sectors of the gross national product is healthcare right now. And I think it's something like 17% of the GMP, which that's not a productive use of resources at all. If you get, you get a strong local food system, that number is going to be a lot lower than 17%. So you're improving your overall economy by strengthen local food system as well.
For the person who's hearing this and likes the idea of finding local to him or local to her sources of food but has no idea how to start, do you have some suggestions on
absolutely. First off, they can start off by joining the Weston Price Foundation. It's $40 a year. They get a great quarterly publication for them where you get in health information there that's worth far more than $40. And Weston Price runs on a chapter leader system. They have hundreds of chapter leaders around the country and actually in other countries as well. But the number one job of the chapter leaders is to find people who call sources of healthy food, whether it's raw milk, grass-fed beef, just or any other foods. So that's one way they can find out. Just another way, especially with dairy, is to go to realmilk.com, which is a Weston Price website. There are other, for mainly sources of raw milk, but I think there are farms that advertise meat and other products in there too. There's a couple other sites, localharvest.com, eatwild.com, where they can also find sources. And I'd also recommend that they join the Farm to Consumer Legal Defense Fund. I mean, Sally Fallon, the president of Weston Price, was responsible more than anyone else for the startup of the Farm to Consumer Legal Defense Fund, whose main mission is to protect the rights of farmers and consumers to engage in direct commerce. And really, the relationship between the two, Dan, is that Weston Price, their job is to find people sources of nutrient-dense food, and the job of the Farm to Consumer Legal Defense Fund is to protect access to those sources. So the two organizations work hand-in-hand in that respect.
Folks, I want to pause here a moment to share with you another podcast. Yes, yes, but it's the Liberty Podcast, so that's okay. My friend Nikki P. of the Free Markets Green Earth Podcast has a few words to tell you about Porcupine Perspective. In case you wonder, the porcupine is the unofficial mascot of libertarians.
Hey, it means the world to Liz and I that you spend the time listening to us. And I'd hate to lose you to another podcast, but I simply have to tell you about my buddy Sean's podcast, The Porcupine Perspective. If you like your liberty raw and unfiltered with just a hint of deep melancholic brooding, then The Porcupine Perspective is the podcast for you. They ponder big themes and real questions. This is hands down one of my favorite podcasts. So go subscribe to The Porcupine Perspective so it can be your second favorite.
Cool. That's a good deal. I will put some of those links on today's show notes page. And now I want to shift gears a little bit into sort of a fun part of the show. Just some simple, short answer questions. Of the five flavors, bitter, sweet, sour, salty, or umami, which one do you enjoy the most?
I'm eating a lot of meat these days, so I'd say salty.
What's your favorite food?
Lamb.
What's your least favorite food?
Soy.
What gets you excited?
Just seeing, love working in this area, just seeing the progress made. Just it's more done on a state by state level with local food, but there, yeah, just some organizations that have helped these states really come a long way in making it more possible for small farmers to make a living and giving providing sources for consumers to buy the food they want.
What turned you off?
Overregulation, bureaucracies that don't know when to stay out of the way, just getting involved when there really isn't a problem, and just the revolving door between the bureaucracies and the major corporations. I mean, when it comes to corporations are the ones with the food safety problems, not the local producers. That's where the bureaucracy should be focusing their time and energy.
What sound do you love?
I live near the coast here. Ocean waves is a great sound to listen to.
What sound do you hate?
Sound of an ambulance. I live near a couple of hospitals here, and when you hear them taking someone in, it's often someone who didn't have the best diet they could have had.
What's your favorite food indulgence?
Oh boy. Let's see. I like great cheese. I've been going through a lot of cheese recently.
Great cheese is spectacular, and that's a worthy indulgence.
I agree.
So you've given me a couple of good websites for information for people to learn. Are there book recommendations, or is this moving too quickly for books?
Well, just a good premiere on the way the food system should be and what's happened with all the regulations is Joel Saladin's book, Everything I Want to Do is Illegal. That book was
an excellent start.
Yeah, written back, I guess, in 2007, but that was the year the Legal Defense Fund started up. And yeah, just his experiences of, Legal Defense Fund's experiences and the work they've done for the most part tracks what's in that book.
And how can people follow your writing? Are you on social media? How can people, if they need to, get in contact with you?
They could. Let's see, I have a blog on realmilk.com. Main purpose of that site is to provide sources of raw milk to people looking for them. But yeah, they can just reach me, Pete at realmilk.com, and occasionally Weston Price will run one of my stories on their Facebook page. So they can just email me at that address or contact Weston Price, and Weston Price will be in touch with me.
Awesome. Well, thank you very much for your time this afternoon to you, almost afternoon to me.
Likewise. Yep. Enjoy the rest of your day.
Well, thank you. You too.
Take care.
All right. Bye-bye. All right, folks, that's going to do it. The link to Pete's article will be on the show notes page, culinarylibertarian.com/86. I'll also add the links he mentioned in the show. I'm also adding the pages for both the U.S. House of Representatives and the U.S. Senate, because why play favorites when it comes to elected leadership? Get them all. There is also a link to Joel Salatin's book, Everything I Want to Do is Illegal, which, as of this May 2020 recording, is free with Kindle Unlimited. I'll also have a link to that program on the show notes page, so you can get your digital books at a better price and sometimes for free. I use it, and it's a great way to fill your library with the things you want to read. I mentioned a surprise a few episodes back. That surprise is a cookbook I'm working on. I think I've finally settled on the title, and now the work of learning how to get it into Kindle and hard copies remains. So, that's the surprise, and soon I'll let you know when it's available for purchase. Subscribe to the Culinary Libertarian Podcast on Apple Podcasts or your favorite podcatcher, and get the episodes delivered right to your device. Have a good week, and I'll see you soon. Music for the Culinary Libertarian Podcast is provided by Matthew Bankert at mattbankert.com.